Welcome to the Grow Bold with Disability podcast, brought to you by Feros Care, a podcast dedicated to smashing stereotypes and talking about the things people with disability care about most to help us live bolder, healthier, better connected lives. I'm journalist Pete Timms.
And I'm Tristram Peters. I work for Disability Service Directory Clickability and I'm a wheelchair user living with spinal muscular atrophy.
Today's episode of Grow Bold with Disability is Growing Bold and Employment and Inclusivity in the Workplace. And our guest is Charles Bryce. Now, Charles is a journalist working for the ABC, and most of you may know him from the ABC News Breakfast in the mornings. He's a quadriplegic after a motorbike accident in 2010. And in this episode, we'll hear about Charles's accident, the diagnosis that he woke up to on that day in 2010, what the diagnosis meant for the young footballer, motorbike rider, and budding commercial pilot, and how a few months spent in the hospital bed led him to a new passion and drive that took him to places he'd never thought he'd go. Charles, welcome to Grow Bold with Disability.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
So, Charles, let's start with that fateful day all the way back in May 2010. You had just started a new job at a mate's farm southeast of Adelaide. Tell us what exactly happened on that day.
Yeah, that's right. It was a bit of a new venture for me. I went from working in a fruit and veg store in Adelaide to, you know, overnight having a new job and living in a new place on a farm. And, you know, I'd done quite a fair bit of farm work in the past, and I'd sort of been there about 6 or 7 weeks, and I was going to go for a motorbike ride. One Saturday morning, just before a game of football, I thought it'd be a nice way to meet a few guys that live around the area. So, it's funny how, one day in your life, and even, 11 years ago, you can remember all the little details of that day. And it just started out as any regular day. And, there were about 6 of us on the bike ride, and probably only, a couple of kilometres from home, not long after we'd sort of rebunched and got together, we headed off again. And, not long after that, I came off the motorbike and I lost consciousness and sort of came to not long after. And I immediately knew something was wrong, and I had plenty of motorbike accidents in my 19 years before that, but this one felt a little bit different. I sort of knew that, it might have been a little bit more serious. So I grew up not knowing what a spinal cord injury was, so I was sort of lying face up in the dirt, fighting for every breath of air, and then not being able to move a muscle to, I couldn't grab the phone that was in my pocket to call for help. I was just stuck there, just waiting and not knowing exactly what I'd done to myself, not knowing why I couldn't move. There were just so many unknowns. And that was probably part of the scary bit, while I was waiting for someone to come and find me.
Now, mate, you know motorbikes. Like, I was reading up, you've been riding bikes since the age of 4. So, what went wrong that day?
As I said, I'd had plenty of bigger stacks on a bike than I did this day, and I had got up and walked away from every single one of them beforehand. I had never broken a bone before this day. Yeah, I can't tell you what went wrong on that day. It was just, mate, it's called an accident for a reason. It's just one of those wrong place at the wrong time, falling, landing on the wrong angle. I wasn't, going flat out. I wasn't mucking around and being a dickhead. I was just, I was at the back of the pack, so I was kind of literally just, really looking forward to getting home and, putting the footy boots on and playing a game. But, that wasn't to be. Mm.
Yeah, and so, an incredibly difficult day for you when you were lying there waiting for your mates. What was going through your mind? You knew something had gone wrong, but you hadn't grasped what exactly had happened. What races through the mind at that point in time?
A lot went through my mind while I was there waiting. I remember just trying to figure out exactly what had gone wrong and why I couldn't move anything. I thought maybe I'd just broken my legs, and I was in, you know, so much shock that I couldn't move. As I said, I had no idea what a spinal cord injury was. It didn't even occur to me that I'd broken my neck. I mean, and the thing is, like, it wasn't all that painful as well. I mean, the only physical feeling that I had was like a little bit of discomfort in my neck, but it was kind of just as if you'd had a bad sleep on a bad pillow or what have you. It was, you know, if you told me before that day that a broken neck wouldn't be painful, I would have probably laughed at you. But, I mean, the beauty of breaking your neck is you can't feel anything. So getting through that part, it wasn't too bad.
Yeah, so 24 hours later, you discover that you've shattered 2 vertebrae in your neck and completely severed your spinal cord, and the doctors told you you'd never walk again, that you'd be quadriplegic for the rest of your life. Tell us about the moment you hear that news. Where does that sort of news sort of take a person in their mind?
Well, this time I was quite sedated, but I do distinctly remember being told by one of the doctors. She said that, you know, there'd be a 5% chance of ever walking again, really. So, but by that stage, like, you know that it's basically all over. I think that was part, like, that moment when I was told, there was so much denial going through my mind, and, you know, I guess I probably knew, but, you know, I didn't want it to be reality, because, you know, I was 19 years old and I was, you know, I was fit, healthy, active, you name it, and I guess, like, you know, every other male 19-year-old that's young and dumb, you probably feel quite invincible, really. So for something like this to happen, it really hits home.
Yeah, and you're then post the diagnosis, and I quote, kept alive by machines and staff in ICU for 52 days before you called the Hampstead Rehabilitation Centre home for the next 14 months. Tell us about that time in rehab. Was the physical or mental side of things more difficult?
It's tricky. I mean, I'd kind of like to think that I was quite mentally strong throughout it. I tried not to have bad days. I'd probably tend to think that I had only bad moments throughout days. It was quite a taxing time, and just coming to terms with reality, because it is a massive, massive change. And, you know, I lost 20 kilos when I was in hospital, and, you know, I didn't look at myself in the mirror for what would have been probably close to, like, at least 3, 4, 5 months. Like, I could just feel it within myself that, I probably just looked like shit. And, you know, I kind of just looked like a bit of a shadow of my former self, really. So, like, there's so many, like, mental challenges within that period. But then too, like, the physical side of it as well. You're only working with a few muscles that are still active. And I went into the rehab center, you know, not being able to lift my arm to even scratch my nose. But then over that 14-month period, I feel quite lucky to have the amount of function and ability that I do now, because, you know, there's always someone worse out there than you.
Now, mate, before the accident, as you mentioned, you're ready to play some footy. You're actively riding motorbikes, working on the farm. You're partway through actually getting your pilot's license to become a commercial pilot. After over a year in hospital, what did the future hold for you?
Well, that was the unknown, really, because, you know, that's from such a young age, that's all I wanted to do. And I'd been around aeroplanes all my life, and I started my license when I was 15. And going through school, there was no plan B for me. It was, you know, I'd sort of set my career path out, and that's the way it was going to go. But having to think of that next step in life in a completely new body, there were so many questions. What was possible? What did I enjoy? There were so many unknowns. But then every day, you know, throughout hospital and rehab, the news would be on. I'd always have a telly on, and you know, there were episodes of news bulletins on what felt like every second hour. So I watched quite a lot, and it sort of helped pass time in rehab, but also started getting quite a bit of enjoyment out of it and quite an interest in it. And, you know, throughout school, my English grades are always sort of up around the best of the lot, sort of the best of the subjects that I was doing. And, you know, I thought I could probably still physically, you know, become a journalist. And so once it was sort of decided that, yes, I could still physically do it, and the interest was certainly there, I thought, bugger it. And about probably about a year and a half out of rehab, I was at uni.
Amazing. And in terms of when you had that epiphany, was it always TV, or was it wanting to do print or radio? What was your thinking? Where did you want to end up?
TV was always where I wanted to be. You know, it's what I – that's where I sort of – I got my interest in journalism, was from watching the news on telly. So I'd always wanted to do it, but I guess in the back of my mind I was like, you know, there's – I haven't seen anyone on TV that's in a wheelchair.
Mm.
You know, no journalist out there has a disability on screen. And yeah, so that was a bit of a challenge. I thought that I would give myself it then too. Like, I was, you know, at that point in time, I was just hoping to get through uni and pass. And I was just, at that point, I was just hoping to get through a journalism degree. And yeah, I guess, again, the unknowns in the future, that I thought I'd just cross that bridge when I came to it.
Yeah, nice. One step at a time. Nice. So what sort of job prospects did you find once you sort of had graduated for, you know, a journalist with a disability?
Well, it's a very competitive market, journalism or media in general, because really you're fighting up against jobs that can be covered across three or more different uni degrees. So you've got journalism, communications, media. So I spent a better part of 9 to 10 months handing out resumes, and by the end of it, you know, I had one interview, and that wasn't even as a journalist. So I was like, I would have taken anything. And then, yeah, by the end of that time, I was just sick of it, and I stopped looking for work. I stopped handing out resumes, and I had a few other projects on the go at that point in time. So I was quite content in actually not sort of having a job at that point. But yeah, lucky enough to get a call from the ABC. I had done a bit of placement throughout there at the end of my degree. So, yeah, I got a phone call from the ABC, and I was able to start part-time at the ABC in the online and in digital space.
Nice.
And so on that, you're a digital producer for ABC in Adelaide, and people can see you reporting most mornings on ABC News Breakfast. You mentioned how competitive it is to become a journalist. I find sometimes as a power to use myself, I have to prove myself above and beyond some of my able-bodied peers. Do you find you have to do the same in your role, or is it just a degree of acceptance and that?
I mean, I always try to do my absolute best no matter the situation, and that has been the case, you know, even before I was in a wheelchair. So, I mean, it is competitive. I guess, you know, in a way, I've just been very, very lucky to end up in the role that I have been. I know that there would be people out there that would give absolutely anything to be doing the role that I'm in. So, I'm certainly not taking that for granted. And I go out there every morning with that in mind and trying to do the absolute best I can, because I would hate to be doing anything else. I'm absolutely loving my role at the moment. Yes, the very early starts at getting out of bed at 4 a.m. but it leaves me in the afternoon to do whatever I like. So it's I've come to learn that morning is the best time of the day. So I'm absolutely loving it.
Now, mate, this is all about employment and then inclusivity in the workplace. Do you think employers have reservations about employing people with disability? Is it, obviously you haven't really come up against it, but do you think it's a big thing out there at the moment?
I guess in a way it's hard for me to say, really, because I don't own a business, but I do know plenty of people with a disability that has had trouble, I guess, getting back into that workforce. I would really hope that they don't have any reservations about people with a disability. I mean, it has been proven that we are more productive. We take less sick days off work. It is 2022 now. So, I think every day that goes by is another day where we are closer to having absolutely everyone being accepting of people with a disability, and that includes in the workforce as well. So, I've sort of always looked at it as, there's never been a better time to be disabled, because, where everything now is becoming more and more accessible, in not just in the workforce but in day-to-day life as well. So, I would generally hope that people aren't, hiding away or actively deterring from employing someone with a disability.
And on that, I speak to a number of my mates who are in power chairs like myself, and they often don't disclose that they have a disability when they apply for jobs for fear that there might be some sort of discrimination. When you were applying for jobs prior to the ABC, did you disclose that you're a quadriplegic, or was it basically hire me on merit, here are my qualifications?
Yeah, I didn't disclose my disability when I was handing out my resume. An initial resume, where that initial point when you're just sending out a resume, I didn't think it was all that important. And I guess, it's going back a few years ago now, but I probably was worried about what people and employers thought, whether some would think, oh, no, it's just a bit too hard. But I wanted to look like just everyone else in that pile of resumes. I wanted, my work to stand out, my experience to stand out, and then, if there were, issues down the track in terms of accessibility, then you manoeuvre that when you need to. I didn't think it was all that important for me to say that I was in a wheelchair.
Mate, you mentioned earlier that you, in inverted commas, didn't see people like you on TV or when you're watching the news or growing up. You didn't see many people with disabilities. What's the feedback been like now from even people within the disability community seeing a person in a wheelchair, a quadriplegic, doing what you do?
The response has been really good. Myself and the cameraman will often have people come up to us when we're out and about just say how nice it is, how nice a job that we're doing. And, I'll get messages quite often from people saying, thank you for doing what you're doing. You're showing my son, my daughter, my partner who has a disability that, you don't that there are, you know, different, there are different options and in life, and that, you know, people don't have to be, or people shouldn't have to worry about what their employment or what their future looks like just because they are disabled.
Yeah, representation matters so, so much. And I was having a conversation with some colleagues at work just the past week around the current labour shortage that we're seeing around the world at the moment. How do you think we advocate that people with disabilities are, you know, are more than capable than anyone to fill these positions that there's shortages in? Like, how do we get that out there and make genuine change?
Oh, man, I wish I had the answers to that, because it would mean that it would be so much easier than what it is. But I think, you know, there are more and more – well, things are becoming more and more visible. You know, I'm on telly every day. We're seeing, you know, the Paralympics being televised on TV and not just, you know, put on a channel, you know, on replay late at night. You know, we've got other people with a disability hosting TV programs as well. So it is getting out there. It does take time, though. You know, it would be amazing just to have a magic wand and to throw it around and for things to be different. But, you know, these things do take time, unfortunately. But I guess it is just having to try and change one person's views, acceptances at a time.
Yeah. I mean, the workforce has also been turned on its head recently too, now that everyone's been, it's acceptable to work from home. Do you think that's going to work in the favour of people with disabilities seeking employment?
Yeah, I think so for sure. You know, and we mentioned disclosing disabilities when you're going for a job interview. Employers might be, you know, having to fork out a lot of money to change up their workspaces to make sure it is accessible, whereas, you know, with people working from home, they may not need to do that. But too, like, and that would, that could also make it a lot easier for people with a disability as well, because, you know, everyone has got a routine to get, you know, to get up, dressed, ready, what have you. So, you know, it is only going to make things easier.
Great.
So, Charles, we'd like to wrap up each episode with the question, what does living a bold life mean to you?
Living a bold life means to me... Well, that's a good question.
Gets in every time.
Yeah, it does. I guess living a bold life for me looks like living a life that I want to live. I'd hate to be stuck at home with no hobbies. I'd love being active and getting out there and stepping outside of my comfort zone as well. Just making the most of every opportunity, because life is so bloody beautiful, you know, there are always people out there that are worse off than you. So living a bold life is just doing, for me, doing what I want when I can, and, you know, along the way just having a whole lot of fun.
Fantastic. And getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning is always beautiful too, mate.
Yeah, well, for about 5 months of the year it is. Come winter, it is nasty, very nasty.
Oh, yeah. Well, Charles, thanks so much for joining us today here on the Grow Bold with Disability podcast, brought to you by Pharos Care. And listeners can find out more about Charles and his great work at EABC in the links provided in today's episode show notes. Charles Bryce, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Dave.
This podcast is brought to you by Pharos Care, an NDIS partner delivering local area coordination services in Queensland, South Australia, and the Australian Capital Territory. Pharos Care is a people care organisation committed to helping people live bolder lives. We call it Growing Bold. And for over 30 years, Pharos has been making it real for both older Australians and those living with disability. To find out more, head to pharoscare.com.au.